From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
It was important because I had come to understand, I had observed from my experience on the court, dealing with colleagues on the court, and from the teaching that I've been doing at different law schools, that the legal profession did not have, the majority of the persons in the legal profession did not have the sense of history that was necessary and would be necessary to make the guarantees of the Constitution and the guarantees in the civil rights, various civil rights acts that had been enacted a reality. And without a sense of history, without knowing the reasons why it's necessary to have civil rights and have them enforced, they will be dead letters. Mm-hmm. And so I, after I retired from the court after 23 years, I felt I was free to express opinions that I could not, in the public arena, that I could not express whilst a sitting judge.
The Honorable Nathaniel R. Jones, of counsel with law firm Blank Rome, retired judge with the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit, and author of Answering the Call, an autobiography of the modern struggle to end racial discrimination in America, published by the New Press. Judge Jones is an unsung hero of the civil rights movement. His story serves as an inspiration to young and old alike who face discrimination because of their race, religion, sexual orientation, or gender. As the title states, the work is devoted to the life of an individual, but is also the story of a civil rights struggle and its impact on one man. Judge Jones's path-breaking career was forged in the 1960s. As the first African-American assistant U.S. attorney in Ohio, as an assistant general counsel on the Kerner Commission, and beginning in 1969, as the general counsel of the NAACP. I'm Johnny O. Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, the Honorable Nathaniel R. Jones, retired judge with the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit, and author of Answering the Call, In Black America.
I was sitting in Mr. Wilkins' office, and he told me why he had asked for the meeting. I was sort of dazed, and he said, and you know, that's the position that Thurgood Marshall held with us. And I said, yes, I'm aware. And he said, but take your time in deciding. I know it's a major decision because you'd have to relocate to New York from mm-hmm. Ohio and move your family, and it'll be a change for you. But I feel that you are a child of the NAACP, and you can be very helpful to us. But the thought of performing the role that Thurgood Marshall had performed, whom I had met as a teenager,
right,
and had the utmost respect for, was awesome. And I after thinking about it for a bit, I felt it was a, as some friends told me, said this is a call, and you cannot say no to a call. And so I accepted the position.
Judge Nathaniel R. Jones is among the nation's most respected jurists. After a long career as general counsel of the NAACP, he was appointed to the U.S. Court of Appeals Sixth Circuit, from which he retired in 2002. As a child growing up in Youngstown, Ohio in the 1930s, he knew something just wasn't right. People were treated differently based on the color of their skin. He recalled what it was like to go to the movies where blacks had to sit in the balcony and whites had to sit on the first floor. Laying the foundation for his future work as a civil rights lawyer, early in his career, Jones served as the executive director of the Youngstown Fair Employment Practices Commission. In 1962, he became the first African-American to be appointed an assistant U.S. attorney for the Northern District of Ohio. In 1967, President Lyndon Baines Johnson appointed him assistant general counsel for the Kerner Commission, which dealt with issues of race in America. On May 17, 1979, President Jimmy Carter announced the appointment of Jones to a judgeship on the Sixth Circuit Federal Court of Appeals. Today, in downtown Youngstown, the federal building and U.S. courthouse bears his name, a fitting monument to a man that truly answered the call.
I was born in Youngstown, Ohio, in 1926. I was one of, in my family, there were four children. My parents moved to, upon their marriage, they moved to Ohio at the in order to find better job opportunities. They moved from Virginia, from Lynchburg, Virginia, to Youngstown, Ohio, because there were job possibilities there. And, of course, shortly after they moved there, the Depression hit.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had those struggles that other families had about that time. So I grew up in Youngstown, and that's where I went to school and went to, after returning from the service in World War II, I enrolled at the college there, which is now a state university.
Right.
And received my undergraduate degree and also my law degree.
Why was it important for you to write this book, your memoir?
It was important because I had come to understand, I had observed from my experience on the court, dealing with colleagues on the court, and from the teaching that I've been doing at different law schools, that the legal profession did not have, the majority of the persons in the legal profession did not have the sense of history that was necessary and would be necessary to make the guarantees of the Constitution and the guarantees in the civil rights, various civil rights acts that had been enacted a reality. And without a sense of history, without knowing the reasons why it's necessary to have civil rights and have them enforced, they will be dead letters.
Mm-hmm.
And so I, after I retired from the court after 23 years, I felt I was free to express opinions that I could not in the public arena that I could not express whilst a sitting judge. And so I had experiences from the time I was a kid, 9 or 10 years old, that I thought would prove of some value to the broader public, because I had the good fortune of being mentored by an outstanding lawyer in my hometown of Youngstown,
mm-hmm.
who exposed me to a lot of the national civil rights leaders. And it was through him that I met Thurgood Marshall and William Hastie and the giants of the civil rights movement, Dr. Clark, whose research was noted by the Supreme Court in the Brown case, and Dr. Robert Weaver, who became the first black to serve in the cabinet by appointment of Lyndon Johnson. So I had a chance to meet all these people. Oh, another one was Walter White, who was the leading civil rights figure of his day, and Roy Wilkins and others. So through those experiences, as a youngster and as I continue to mature and grow, I absorbed a great deal of the events
mm-hmm.
that were taking place, and I felt that I should share those experiences, and the best way I could share them would be through an autobiography, and that way I would put at the I'd be putting before a number of people, Americans, students, lawyers, and others, policymakers, I'd be putting before them the experiences that I observed and that I went from observing to participating in. And that's why I felt I should record those experiences for the benefit of current policymakers and those who come along in the future.
Yeah, I understand. You talk about your mentor, J. Maynard Dickerson, who also kept you employed for a good part of your juvenile years.
Yes, he did. He was, in addition to being a lawyer, he's also a newspaper publisher and operated a printing company. And so he took me under his wing at a very early age played an important role in my life because he detected quite early that I was I had some deficiencies with regard to learning and what I was doing in school.
Right.
And he sort of pulled my chain and got me back on track and impressed upon me the importance of being able to write and to be prompt and to know the art of communication. And all of those attributes came to serve me well when I was offered opportunities as I grew older. And so he was an important figure in my life and in my development.
Tell us about being the executive director of the Youngstown Fair Employment Practices Commission.
Well, that was an interesting period of my life. After World War II, the federal FEPC was defunded because the Southern congressman contended that the necessity for it had ended with the war, with war being over, and so it became clear that the country benefited from having fair employment emphasis. People were working on jobs they never had before.
Mm-hmm.
Employers were experiencing employees that they never had experienced before. So in order to fill that gap, a number of states and cities began to enact fair employment practices, statutes, and ordinances. And in addition to that, there was a constant drumbeat to have Congress enact fair employment statute, which they finally did in 1964 with the Civil Rights Act and Title VII, which became the vehicle. But to go back to the FEPC in Youngstown, it was an effort to preserve what little gains that had been made during the war in the industries in that city, primarily the steel industry, and also to try to expand opportunities in commercial employment for people of color. And what we had to rely upon was persuasion, the opportunities to work with employers to prevail upon them to preserve equal opportunity and fair employment for persons that they had not utilized before. And so I did that for 3 years, and we made a little progress, but it was not dramatic. But during that time, the state of Ohio was preparing to join those other states that had enacted a statewide fair employment law, such as New York and California and Connecticut and other states. And so in 1958, the state of Ohio passed a statewide civil rights law that included Fair Employment Practice Commission. And with that, the cities began to cede their efforts over to the state, which had enforcement powers. And it's still functioning in Ohio, and other states are still functioning with their fair employment laws, and they work in cooperation with the U.S. Commission on fair employment, the EEOC, which was a creature of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, and it's been amended several times to increase its enforcement powers and its effectiveness. So the experience I had at FEPC in Youngstown was just another step in my evolvement, and it stood me in good stead when I went with the NAACP and as its general counsel, and also as when I was appointed to the court. The experiences that I had along the way served as really building blocks for what I was ultimately to do. And I met responsibilities without any thought of the next step. I did the best I could at the job that that was before me, and that served to really prepare me for the next step. But I have been the beneficiary of opportunities that teach me the value of a give back and helping those who haven't quite got over yet. So that's why I continue to be involved and active, and it's a reason that I felt I should record those experiences so that the next generation can have the benefit of what I learned and to build on it, because there's still a lot of folks who haven't gotten over yet, and we have to always be mindful of our obligation to those who are coming behind us.
When you were asked by Executive Director of the NAACP, Warren Wilkins, to become General Counsel, you were asked to follow in the footsteps of Thurgood Marshall. Were those big shoes to fill?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, as I was sitting in Mr. Wilkins' office, and he told me why he had asked for the meeting, I was sort of dazed, and he said, and you know, that's the position that Thurgood Marshall held with us. And I said, yes, I'm aware. And he said, but take your time in deciding. I know it's a major decision, because you'd have to relocate to New York from Ohio and move your family, and it'll be a change for you. But I feel that you are a child of the NAACP, and you can be very helpful to us. But the thought of performing the role that Thurgood Marshall had performed, whom I had met as a teenager,
right,
and had the utmost respect for, was awesome. And after thinking about it for a bit, I felt it was a, as some friends told me, said it's this is a call, and you cannot say no to a call. And so I accepted the position, and was well received in the national office. The staff support was great. People were very gracious and supportive and helpful. But as soon as I hit the ground, in fact, even before I began my official duties, I was asked by Mr. Wilkins to undertake an assignment out in California involving some students who had been expelled and indicted and prosecuted for taking over an administration building at San Fernando State College. And so before I was officially NAACP General Counsel, I was out in California organizing a legal team to provide a defense for those students. And that was my introduction. I didn't have a honeymoon period. I plunged in even before, and then as soon as I started my responsibilities, I had to deal with all kinds of crises, different cities, issues that are still with us today: police community relations, violence, a whole range of issues, school segregation, and a demand by parents that something be done about the quality of the schools and the education their kids were receiving, So I was, I sort of hit the ground running. And not only, that's why I say I moved from an observer to a participant. And as a participant, I often had to be the spear to move forward and to help mobilize actions to attack the wall of discrimination, the segregation, which was very formidable.
In the book, Judge Jones, you also talk about the tragic death of your first wife and the struggle you had with raising an infant daughter. Why was that story important to tell?
Well, it was important because my, you know, my first wife was, she was a remarkable a woman. She came from a great family. She was a niece of Dr. W.B. Du Bois.
Right.
That was just that's a side issue. But we had hopes of a great life together.
Mm-hmm.
And we unexpectedly discovered that we were going to be parents. And that was a source of great joy. But before we could really enjoy the life we had planned, she was troubled and unable to cope. And there I was with a two-month-old baby and a budding career, because I had just finished, I just passed the bar, and I was starting my law career, and which required me to be away a great deal, and I could not be away and yet attend to my responsibilities as a father. So I had the benefit of a caring mother and sister, and everybody just embraced me and gave me the support I needed to continue my along with my career, and to yet meet my responsibilities for my child. And it was a struggle, but I couldn't have done it without my my family.
You devote a whole chapter to Supreme Court Associate Justice Clarence Thomas. Why so?
Well, as I noted, I occupied the shoes of Thurgood Marshall.
Mm-hmm.
Thurgood Marshall was a protege of Charles Hamilton Houston.
Right.
They developed, Houston really took the lead. Marshall always gave Houston the credit, but it was together that they developed what we called, we lawyers call, the Houstonian School of Jurisprudence. That was a theory of litigation that successfully attacked and overturned Jim Crow, the Plessy versus Ferguson decision, that it that validated separate but equal. That decision, the Brown versus Board of Education decision, was a launching pad for a meaningful attack upon segregation all across the board. It went beyond schools.
Mm-hmm.
It provided the inspiration for people all across this country to look into their own communities and realize that they didn't have to continue taking that stuff, that they were able to rely upon the courts, and validated the role that courts could play and that law could play in ending Jim Crow and bringing about the realization of the Constitution, the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendments. And so Clarence Thomas was a beneficiary of all of that, and he so declared that he that it were not for affirmative action, for instance, which is an outgrowth of the Brown decision, that he doesn't know where he would be. And then as soon as his nomination is confirmed, in fact, before that, when he was what I call when he was prepping for to succeed Justice Marshall, because it was pretty clear that Justice Marshall was ailing and would not survive another term under the Bush administration, that President Bush, George Herbert Walker Bush, would have an appointment to the Supreme Court. He would be appointing a replacement. And it was generally thought that, well, the replacement should be somebody in the mode of Justice Marshall. But no, those who were influencing President Bush, a group like the Federalist Society, the group that's a conservative think tank organization, they were casting about for someone to put in the queue to take the place of Marshall when he retired. And they felt that the most effective political move would be to find a black lawyer judge who could be confirmed.
Mm-hmm.
And so they it was at that time that Clarence Thomas left the job of chair of EEOC, was appointed to the D.C. Court of Appeals, and there he was. That's where he waited until the time was right. And one way he convinced the conservatives that he was the right person was when he challenged Justice Marshall in a speech that he'd given out in Hawaii, in which Marshall discussed the Constitution and the Founding Fathers, and that they had not gotten it right. That is the Constitution, and that's why we had to have the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendments to give the Constitution's real meaning as it related to African Americans. Well, Thomas wrote a piece in a San Diego newspaper that blasted Justice Marshall and disparaged him, and that was the transition that he undertook, that convinced the conservatives, the states' rights people, the Federalist Society people, that he was a trustworthy person for their purposes.
The Honorable Nathaniel R. Jones, of counsel with Blank Rome, retired judge with the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit, and author of Answering the Call. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to your future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Remember to like us on Facebook and to follow us on Twitter. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny L. Hansen, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.